Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very excited about today's morning show because I suspect it's going to be one of those programs in which I learn a lot and you, the listeners, learn a lot as well about something that is very important and yet one of those, in a sense, largely invisible presences in our lives, in our collective lives of our culture, namely the issue of copyright and copyright protection of intellectual property, and the way in which our lives so often intersect with copyright issues without us even knowing it. And those of us who are active in academic circles especially run into kind of vexing, complex questions and problems and concerns related to copyright, copyright protection, copyright law, as it has been originally conceived and as it has evolved over the past years. An event is coming up at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside on Friday morning, the 25th of September, so a week from this coming Friday, right, in which some of the issues involving copyright are going to be explored. And a number of interesting guests are being brought in by a group of people at Parkside who think of themselves on a thought of as Parkside's copyright team. And we have two members of the copyright team joining us today on the morning show. One of them will be very, very familiar to many of you, Lisa Konetsky, for many years a stalwart presence on the theater faculty of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and many times over a guest on this morning show. Joining us also, but for the very first time, is Laura Mason, who is Creative Services Manager at Parkside in the Office of University Relations and Advancement. And in many ways, she is at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside the authority figure when it comes to copyright and all that it involves. And this event is designed in part not only to understand sort of the rights and wrongs involved in copyright, but also the way in which understanding copyright can help us do more innovative and creative things. Understanding copyright also allows us to understand what we are freely allowed to use, and so it's also about open doors, not just closed doors. And we'll talk a little more about that today. So, Laura Mason, Lisa Konetsky, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for letting us come and talk about this.
I'm really glad we get to do this. This is something that I feel like I need to know a lot more about, and I also feel like not only do academic professors need to know about this kind of thing, but and anybody involved in the creative arts and performing arts especially, but also just anybody who consumes entertainment of and culture of just about any kind needs to have some understanding of this, and certainly young people who live in kind of a new digital landscape in which copyright is kind of a almost a quaint notion need to understand that there's nothing quaint about copyright protection. It's important and vital, and it's something we all need to understand a little bit better. Laura, maybe you could say a word about when and why this so-called copyright team was formed at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. What kind of need was it addressing or questions addressing?
Well, copyright is so complex, and you feel like you're kind of isolated around the university, that we deal with so many different areas of copyright. Fair use in the classrooms. We deal with marketing and publicity and theater and music. Then we also have films that we're licensing and showing in our theater. So we cover a lot of different aspects of copyright. And trying to deal with it just on your own was kind of overwhelming. So we had just hired, or one of our librarians had just become our official copyright librarian. And she was dealing with aspects of fair use. I was dealing with things like publicity. I was in charge of making sure that things that we were printing were okay to print, and designing and making sure our student designers weren't using things that they shouldn't for publicity purposes. So we kind of got together and started talking, and it felt like kind of a relief that someone else, you know, you had another brain to pick, you know, when it came to figuring out all the different aspects of copyright. Our director of our library decided that, well, maybe, you know, this was working really well with just the two of us, but maybe we should expand that to cover the areas of film and theater and music and other areas around the campus. So we got together a more wide and varied team from around the school so that we could discuss all these issues. And so it wasn't just one person, you know, saying yes or no to a, you know, a question. We could say, throw it out to the team and say, you know, what's your take on this sort of thing?
You know, the way you describe that really underscores the complexity of copyright protection and the fact that probably in some cases, maybe there's a right or wrong answer, but sort of arriving at that is maybe going to be a complicated process. And maybe in some cases, we're talking about a judgment call. Is that right?
Absolutely. Copyright is very gray. I mean, the cases that get decided, you think you're covered, but sometimes it's more of a matter of, in our instance, we have a copyright team. It would show a judge, if we were ever to go to court, that we are trying to be good citizens of copyright. Mm. And so that would work in our benefit.
I see.
In a copyright decision.
So if somebody saw something printed at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, a publicity poster for something, and it utilized a copyright image, and who owned that copyright saw that and took you to court, the fact that Parkside has at least a copyright team to work with copyright issues, that would be seen as a plus, that you were giving a good faith effort to do things properly.
Exactly.
Versus a place that seems to not care about those issues whatsoever.
And I think if I can just add, one of the things that the copyright team has started to do around the university is to put up posters, put things on the website, send emails to faculty and student groups saying, do you have a question? Call the copyright team. So to try to get the word out there that you need to be thinking about these things before you go forward, and there are places to go that may not have an immediate answer, but where those questions can be discussed. And so really promoting the idea that people need to be thinking about copyright. I think the fact that there's a team really allows people to have more of a sense that you don't just go to a button on the website and get an answer to your question.
Right, or a person.
Or a person.
Lisa, tell us about your presence on this copyright team. I mean, is that something that you sort of eagerly stepped up to do, or were you elected by your peers when you were out of the room, or how did this happen?
Well, I wasn't elected. This isn't a governance group, so there's no election here. But the way that I got involved was a little bit later in the process, as Laura is smiling at me, but Laura knows that I am always asking questions about, you know, can we use this? What about this piece of music? Or, you know, we would like to use this image. In terms of the performing arts and the publicity that we do, we're behind a lot of the people who have more expertise in copyright. So I'd been asking a lot of questions. And I went to the first copyright day and I felt like I had found the Lord or something. I got the sense of there's a place to go to answer my questions, and at least a place where I can share some of the concerns that we have over the complex issues that we have with performance. So I was asking a lot of questions and doing some follow-up, and then I was asked as a faculty member, particularly because of the specific kinds of questions I had, to be a member of the team. And I think some of my function has just been to raise these questions, particularly around music, publicity and music. And then I have some experience with copyright when it comes to the rights to plays and things that we produce. So that's my involvement. I don't have the expertise, but I have a lot of questions.
Right. Well, that's part of what I wanted to ask, because it sounded like, you know, you for, you know, probably in part because, you know, you're I think, an exceptionally ethical person. And so these, you know, someone else, I'm not accusing your colleagues of this, but just in general in your field, there's probably plenty of people who have a rather lackadaisical approach to all of this. And then others like yourself who really take this seriously, the matter of honoring the copyright protection of something that somebody else has created. But it's one thing to be asking these questions about, is this okay, is this okay? And it's another thing to sit on the team that, in a sense, helps to determine the answer to the questions you've been raising. So, well, in a sense, you're on both sides of the table now.
I think scholars and artists believe, in general, I would say, that people should be paid for the work that they create. And I certainly everyone I would say that I know in my department feels very strongly that artists deserve to be remunerated for their work. At the same time, when you're directing a play, as I do, and you're looking for music, I mean, everything is out there to grab.
Right.
And we don't always think about, oh, wait a second, this is something that's copyrighted. Or this is something that someone else has created. So you pay for the rights to a play, for instance, but you don't necessarily always think about a projection that you might use, an image you might take off the internet, or a piece of music that you might use. And so I think we're kind of catching up to the fact that we need to think about these things, and we need to honor those artists, and at the same time we need to think about how that impacts the resources that we have. Because to pay for a song to use in a production, for instance, is a pretty can be a very expensive, you know, a prohibitively expensive thing to do.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking today about copyright with two people from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, who both happen to sit on Parkside's so-called copyright team. Lisa Kornetsky, who is from the theater faculty, and Laura Mason, who is creative services manager for UW Parkside in their Office of University Relations and Advancement. And what precipitates this conversation today is an event which is coming up at Parkside, Copyright Day, and an event on Friday morning, the 25th of September, in which an array of special guests are being brought in to speak to the issue and various issues around copyright protection. Lisa, you mentioned Copyright Day as though it's already happened. I mean, so this is not the first?
This is the second, yes.
So tell us about the first event. Was it somewhat comparable to the one that's coming up on the 25th?
Yes, it was a half-day seminar, and we had a main speaker and then several breakout sessions covering various different topics. This year, our main speaker is Nancy Sims, who's a copyright librarian and a lawyer, and she writes a copyright blog, so she's going to be our keynote. And then we have six breakout sessions. And we're covering various different topics. In fact, because Lisa had so many questions about music, it became a hot topic, and in the area probably where we had the least knowledge. So we invited an expert to come in to speak to the topic of music, and that's Naz Pantaloni, who's coming in to speak about that. We also have a group from KUSD who had put together a fantastic copyright program for the unified system, and they're going to talk to other administrators and teachers about getting that kind of program for their schools and how to build it for students and parents and for teachers. So they cover a lot of different aspects. I'm talking about marketing and copyright. We have printing done in our office, and in my area, the person who presses the copy button, it's a $10,000 fine if you get caught printing something that you isn't isn't covered by copyright. So, so that's why we're so cautious about it.
Understandably. by the way, you mentioned in passing that the person that with whom you began working so closely on this issue was Parkside's copyright librarian, and I know that Nancy Sims is essentially the copyright librarian at the University of Minnesota. What does a copyright librarian do? And do most university libraries have a copyright librarian?
Ann Rasmussen was our copyright librarian. It was one of her duties. So she would take questions mainly from faculty and students that addressed copyright and how fair use, whether something was covered by fair use in the classroom. And when she found that she was having issues with things like where students were copying things for publicity for the student orgs or something, and she had questions about that, it didn't fall under her realm, which is how we kind of got linked up.
So between your two different areas, you had more you could sort of cover and questions you could answer.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about copyright itself and when it was first created. And of course, it was a few generations ago that the notion of copyright protection didn't exist at all. And do you know very much about the history of where copyright protection was first crafted?
Well, copyright's covered in our Constitution. So back in 1760 is when they first drafted the first look at copyright. And
is that anywhere, as far as you know? Or I mean, did copyright exist elsewhere in the world? Is this something, for instance, Britain did before we got around to it? Or
it did, and our founding fathers knew that it was used as a censorship tool, as well as something that was kept for generations within families, and they wanted something that would be more freeing, that would help society as a whole. Where you could take something and build on it, but still be of benefit to the artists, so they would continue to produce works. So they limited copyright protection. They said the artist had the right to reap economic benefit for 14 years, and then it would go into the public domain, where then the knowledge base would increase. You would learn from the technological advances in science, that sort of thing.
So it was conceived in a sense, in a much more limited way. It was as much to limit copyright protection as it was to enforce it. It enforced it for a short period and then opened the floodgates, in a sense, for that to be more freely disseminated then.
Correct. They wanted it to benefit society. They saw it as we have a common knowledge base and we build on that. But they didn't want to take away the rights of the artists so that they wouldn't, feel like they weren't getting anything out of it. But it was very much limited, and that has changed drastically over the years. We've had several changes to copyright law. Currently, with the last reiteration of copyright law, it's 70 years beyond the life of the artist.
70 years after the artist in question dies.
Right. And the people who are behind this are mainly the estates of people. Like the Gershwin family were big into seeing that copyright got expanded. The Walt Disney Corporation, the motion picture industry, they want these rights to continue on long for a much longer period so that they're reaping economic benefit.
So is this a cause of contention, would you say? I mean, like, for instance, I don't know how much you know about this, but I'm curious. If this has aroused much in the way of public discourse, beyond even congressional debate on whether or not it really is true to the original principles of copyright protection to extend it in this way, or is it just sort of being done without much of those kind of questions being grappled with?
It's mainly we see it in the public discourse where it surrounds music is a big area where that is. You think about the songs that you grew up with, all the old blues tunes. They were kind of built on old tunes, and there were certain riffs you'd recognize. And as we've grown as a society, that's become more and more and more protected. And you're seeing more people being sued over, I've you know, recognized that sample of my music and you didn't give me credit for it or you didn't license it. And so it's become a bit of an issue. And most recently, we've seen that there was a lawsuit between the Marvin Gaye's family and the artists Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke. They lost over $7 million with a tune called Blurred Lines. They had created this tune, and it had the essence of Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up from the 70s. It didn't sample the tune. It didn't use the lyrics from the tune. However, it had the essence of that song. And so the jury decided that, yes, it was a copyright violation and awarded the family a great deal of money for it.
Wow. So explain what copyright potentially can protect. It obviously can protect a play that somebody writes, a piece of music that somebody composes, and it sounds like copyright can also protect a given image. So, for instance, when somebody takes a photograph, that can be copyrighted?
Basically, any idea that you can come up with and put into some sort of form can be copyrighted. Images, on the internet, we have a tendency to think things are free.
Right.
But if it's put in some sort of tangible form, that is copyrighted. And that's where we see a lot of, I think, where the next reiteration of copyright law will come. We see a lot of things being just freely taken on the internet and used. For example, you see memes of Star Wars characters and other people's images. And I think that's where the next round of discussion will come, when people start seeing things that they really didn't want to share with the world being used in ways that they didn't want them used.
Help us. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, and I certainly don't know as much as Laura does, and I'm not very aware of the larger legal discussion that's going on out there. But my sense of it is that this discussion is like so many things related to technology, that the technology is moving much faster than the law is, or than even public discussion is. And so the way that legislation happens and is based on what lawsuits come forward and who's questioning these things. But I don't think as a society we've had that really big debate or conversation about how, particularly with social media, but how technology impacts the way we think about copyright and the way we think about, private information. So I think we're catching up, and some of the purpose of our having this discussion is to try to even figure out what are the big issues, not just the specific answers to questions, but what are the big issues that we as a university and as a society have to grapple with as we move forward.
Right. And of course, one among many questions is, does copyright law as it is currently crafted even fit this new technological landscape in which we all live and function? I mean, or should it be adapted, or should it not be? Should it exist? And the fact that we have this touch of a button facility, the ability to do this, doesn't mean we should. And so maybe the copyright law as it stands should remain ironclad and relatively inflexible. But that's a question for us to grapple with. And I think you're right. At this point, we really haven't, not on a national scale, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, not that I'm aware of.
No, and one of the more interesting copyright questions came from my oldest son, and he was talking about how he's into gaming, and he watches reviews on YouTube. And gamers will review games and use little short clips of the game.
Hmm.
Well, YouTube will pull down copyright violations. So he was finding that companies that liked the gaming reviews would leave those up, and the ones who didn't like the reviews were having them pulled from YouTube. So he was seeing it as a censorship sort of thing. And he came to me with that question. It was a very interesting sort of thing. To have to deal with those kind of issues. It's like, okay, now we're seeing copyright being used as a club.
Right. You know, being used very selectively for one's own gain, and it's in a way that it was not really conceived of, probably, by those who framed copyright protection.
Right. And I think that's a discussion that we also need to have, is when does it cross that line into censorship? And, you know, that's another discussion that our copyright team has kind of, we grapple with.
Right. Can you help us understand the mechanics by which copyright protection is secured? I know a little bit about back in the Stone Age, how one did that. I mean, back when I was in college. But I really don't have much sense at all now of how one secures copyright. If I took a picture right now of the two of you and decided I wanted to copyright that image so it doesn't end up on thousands of posters across the country, how would I do that?
Well, that's another interesting part about copyright. There is a copyright office, and you can copyright, you can pay the fee and fill out the forms and have something copyrighted. But you technically don't have to do that. You've created it. It's in some tangible form. It's yours. It's now copyrighted. There are other...
Just by the act of creating it, essentially.
Yes.
And so when I write a piece of music, I wrote a song last week, and that song is copyrighted without me doing anything official to make that happen.
Correct.
Wow.
That is, you have your own copyright. You don't have to do anything to prove that you have a copyright until it comes up in a court of law. That's when people would like, you know, they use the copyright office to say that I own this. But there are some other sites. I believe one's called meow.com, which can do it in a different capacity. But there are other things like Creative Commons, which allows you to put your work out and give it selective rights so that people can use it to build on. For example, when I was doing research on copyright law, there was a lot of information that was out there on Creative Commons that artists had put out there because they wanted people to use it, but they wanted to get credit for it. So they put it out there. They say, you can use this with these certain rights. You can use it for public broadcast or not, but they tell you what the rights are that you can use that specific thing under. And music's being done that way now. Photos are being done that way. There's a lot of different things that you can do.
Now, even when you make that choice, are you, in a sense, giving up part of what full-fledged copyright protection would grant you?
It depends on which rights you grant. You can give, for example, you can say, you're welcome to perform this music. If you are going to do it in some sort of public broadcasting manner where it might be on the radio or something, maybe then I don't give away those rights. Or you can't record it and then make money off of my song. They can give away whatever sets of rights that they want to with Creative Commons.
Interesting. Lisa, you work, of course, in the realm of theater. So your own expertise is probably most secure when it comes to copyright protection of, for instance, theatrical plays. Is there anything particularly strange about that? The way that works? It doesn't seem like it. It seems like it's relatively straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward, but over time there have been a number of issues that have come up for us. So, you know, one example would be, and I think Laura mentioned this before, that for dramatists who have produced work and it's still under copyright, depending on the playwright, there are some playwrights who are kind of whose estates are famous for being incredibly restrictive in terms of what they'll let people do. So Samuel Beckett is an example, or Bertolt Brecht. We did Three Penny Opera a number of years ago, and when we wanted to change the makeup of the orchestra, that is strictly prohibited. So, you know, you use the orchestration that you have paid for, and if you want to use less, you can't. Well, that becomes a real resource issue for us.
Yeah.
Other examples would be, we have a staged reading series where we do not charge admission. And the whole, it's called Fresh Ink, and
right,
the whole purpose of that is to produce newer work that we might not be able to produce, to really inform our audiences of new work and really get people excited about some of that. Well, we used to believe and understand that because it was fair use, we weren't charging admission. We weren't fully producing it. It was kind of a workshop, and therefore we didn't have to pay copyright. But of course, when we investigated that, we realized that we do have to pay copyright. And the copyright for that has turned out to be no different than the copyright fee that we would pay for a show in our smaller theater. So, you know, we then grapple with the resource issue. So I think in those ways, things that in previous times we just sort of, I don't know, understood, this is fair use. We don't have to pay for this. That's changed. Certainly our use of music in theatrical production, we really need to catch up with the fact that we can't use a Marvin Gaye song as pre-show music without paying for that, and that in ways we have been, without realizing it previously, not living up to the code of the law. It is interesting, though, anytime you produce a piece of work, I'm sure it's the same with music, and you're creating an artwork based on images from other artwork, you are putting your own creative stamp on that artwork. So as you change, you know, if something is, think about Shakespeare. When people do Shakespeare, which is in the public domain, obviously, people do all kinds of things. You know, you can take Romeo and Juliet and set it on the moon. I mean, you can do anything you want to try to make the statement that you want to make. But if you take something that's not in the public domain and you change that conceptually, you're actually breaking copyright law. So your desire to produce a piece of artwork and do what we think is usually the intention of a playwright, right? To put that work out there and have it transcend its time and space and respond to what's happening in the world. You know, it's a fine line in terms of how you interpret that and how you understand the playwright's intent.
Yes, and it's interesting how different creators will have very different ideas about what they want. And as you were saying earlier, Laura, the level of protection or restriction which they want to have on their work, that there are those creators who, those artists who welcome the wide dissemination of what they've created and for people to put their own stamp on it, and others who, for whatever reason, do not have that kind of openness at all.
Right.
Really interesting to think about what's going on there. I mean, even that kind of discussion would be interesting to have, to hear from various artists on why they make the choices they do to retain or release restrictive control.
One of the more interesting things, and we were talking about this, and I think Laura has a better memory than I of the details, is just with the current political season, we've been talking about the use of music to support various campaigns and how artists have been very clear if they potentially don't support the particular candidate who chooses to use their music to sue for large sums of money, and to be very clear that they do not want their music to support this candidate. And the most recent example that we kind of came up with was the – you're going to be able to describe it better than I think.
In the – just within the past month or so,
right,
we saw that Kim Davis and Mike Huckabee had used Eye of the Tiger when she was released from jail, the case with the Kentucky registrar who did not
approve gay marriages and would not issue licenses. When
right.
she was released from jail, she and Mike Huckabee came out to Eye of the Tiger. And they are now being sued for $1.2 million.
Yes, because those who created that song don't want that song being used in that way.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, this, and now let's, we might as well start hacking our way through the jungle of music issues involved with copyright. So somebody writes a song, and then somebody, maybe them or someone else, records that song. So first of all, it seems to me we're talking about two different things being protected. Number one, the song itself, and number two, the recording of that song. And there might be 40 recordings of that song, each, I assume, also protected by copyright. How separate are those two items, the song being protected, each recording of it being protected?
Music has so many levels of copyright protection. They have the artist who writes it. They have the recording of it. They have the venue where it's being performed sometimes has to have a license to be able to play the music. There are public broadcasting rights if it's played over the air and recording. So there are a lot of different people who get royalties in a lot of different places. And they're, I believe, is it AFSCME is the company that, and BMI are the two big ones that cover that. And oftentimes it's like you pay one fee and they split up the royalties. But there are so many different levels to music copyright, which is one of the reasons we wanted to bring in an expert on it.
Right.
Because so many of us are, you know, we know our little area of copyright, but, you know, I deal mainly with print and electronic, and music is a little bit more nebulous, and so I want to go to the session on music copyright so I can learn more.
Right. One of my direct encounters with this is, and I will be the first to admit, I'm scandalously lackadaisical when it comes to either knowing about this or even thinking about this. But a little quartet that I own, well, now it's a trio, but the first time we put a compact disc together, several of the things were pre-existing songs that we liked and wanted to sing, and we actually hired somebody to go out and try to secure and figure out who owned the copyright for these various songs. We wanted to really do it right. I was amazed at what she ended up uncovering, that in some cases, a song, the rights to that song would be split up between five or six different people, that this person or this company owns 30% of it and 20% owns, I mean, like it's been passed down or divvied up in different ways. Song after song after song was like that. It wasn't that the person who wrote it retained 100% rights to it. And so then for us, although we did our very best, but for us to try to secure permission from
very
all of these different entities,
yeah.
I mean, it was a nightmare. And to me, to my amateur eye, that doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem like that somehow seems like a misuse of copyright, that it makes it needlessly difficult for someone who would like to pay proper tribute to whoever has created it to do so. It becomes almost impossible.
It is. It's a very difficult area to kind of wade through to try and figure out. The Beatles famously sold their rights to all their songs back in the 60s. And we know that Michael Jackson now owns, his estate now owns a catalog of Beatles songs. So these rights get sold and bought, and catalogs belong to various different people. And it's very hard to figure out who owns those rights. The one of the interesting things that we have found when we were doing research for copyright, England actually has a copyright day where they celebrate things going into the public domain.
Really?
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And it's like they celebrate it as part of, and I kind of like that idea because I like the idea of being able to expand upon an artist's work. I mean, like we talked about before, most of the music that you grow up on, it's like, it has essence of music that you heard previously, and it grows. And, you know, I think of Muddy Waters and B.B. King, and a lot of the riffs that you hear are famous blues riffs. It's like you wouldn't want to see those songs disappear because someone was being sued over copyright. So it's a fascinating thing, but it's also really complicated.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, at least it can be.
And
then there are certain cases where it's not very complicated. One of my favorite examples was at Carthage, actually. This is a few years back, but a very fine soprano named Nicole Cabell, who's been a lead solo singer at the Lyric and the Met and so on, for several years came and did master classes at Carthage. The first time she did a master class with a number of our students, towards the very end, as I was thanking everybody for coming, and then I made mention of the fact that Nicole Cabell had this lovely and very highly regarded and enthusiastically reviewed Aria's album that had just been released by London, and I was encouraging the students, and someone raised their hand and asked, what was the name of that, of the album again? And one of the other sopranos sitting in the same pew just leaned over and said, oh, I have that. You can copy it from me. And I just looked at her, and I just couldn't believe that those words came out of her mouth. 5 feet away from where Nicole Cabell was standing. I mean, here to, oh yeah, I have that. You can copy my copy of your album. I was just appalled. I mean, not that I haven't a few times in my life done exactly the same thing, but I was just amazed at her cluelessness. I mean, I won't say this lovely student's name, but I didn't think she was so lovely in that moment. I was just appalled that she would have that kind of disregard. And that this is some years ago. I mean, back when some people still owned compact discs, and of course now with everything going so digital, in some ways it's probably even more likely that a student might say something like that or think that and just think
and
nothing.
Have no idea. And
right.
Have no idea. And I think one of the things that's it sort of goes to your point of the music, you know, trying to find out who has the rights and how to pay for them. When you're trying to do the right thing and find out, you know, you want to use the image or the song or whatever, and you're trying to find out who owns the copyright or how to use that, that information isn't always easy to find. I just had a question for Laura recently about an image that I wanted to use by Winslow Homer that is certainly, I assume, in the public domain. I'm not sure. But, you know, we have certain licenses at the university that allow us to go to sites where images are available to download. But trying to find the particular image, who owns that image, I mean, all of that takes time. So I think one of the things that is difficult is even when you know, it's a resource issue, but it's also a time issue. That information is not always clear. And so I think for people who come to the copyright day, just understanding what are these licenses, who has them, how do I have access, how do I find what I need, I think some of that information will become much more readily available for people who come to this, because it is quite a I don't know what the word is, but it's something to navigate.
Yeah.
In copyright when you understand that you need to pay for something and you're just trying to figure out who owns it. How do I
right.
find it? How do I pay for it?
And it's become so muddy. We find that things like Google Images, you can just Google and there are a bunch of images. And you think because it's on the internet, it's like
you can
right click, save, and I can use the image. But that's not how it works. And trying to explain that to students is very important, that when they're doing their classwork, by all means, you can use things for, if it's fair use, it's covered in your homework, but when you're advertising for your club, you can't go out and use Beyonce's image, you know? It's the difference between what's fair use and what's not fair use. And so those are the kinds of issues that we want our students to be aware of.
Can you just say a word about that term fair use? We've actually bandied it about, but I don't think we've taken the time yet to even say what that really is referring to.
Fair use is basically the idea that you want ideas to be part of our education system. And you want teachers to be able to go out and talk about issues and maybe current topics or say there's an article in the newspaper that relates to a history assignment that you gave out. You might want to bring that into the classroom and be able to make a copy for your students and discuss it. It's a learning tool. And fair use is a defense that is allowed under copyright protection that allows teachers and for learning purposes to use copyrighted material in the classroom and give certain allows the students to be protected from being sued, allows professors and teachers, school systems to be protected for using those things as a learning tool for their students.
So I can play off of some compact disc to my classroom as I'm trying to demonstrate something.
Yeah.
But Lisa can't play that CD at the start of her play.
Right.
That's something that's crossed a line from the classroom to a public performance.
Yes. And that's that line that we have to kind of teach our students about is when does it cross that line from fair use into not.
Early on, I said something to the effect that sometimes it sounds like this involves judgment calls. To what extent is that true, that sometimes questions come up and they are really vexing questions with no hard and fast, cut and dried answer?
Anne Rasmussen, who was our copyright librarian, had gone to a copyright conference a while back, and she said it was fascinating to listen to this panel they were given a scenario by the audience, you know, and then asked to give their answer. And she said it was fascinating because while they all came up with the same conclusion, the way that they came about it was completely different, and their reasoning behind it was completely different. And that's the part that's fascinating.
Yeah.
There are so many different areas of gray in copyright, and we find that sometimes it's the judge or the jury who are listening to it or seeing it, and it's their judgment call as to whether it was actually copyright infringement. And some things that you think may be fair use. There was a famous case where public broadcasting used an 80-second clip of a symphony performance. It was for education. It was a educational program. It was nonprofit. It was a limited use, and yet it was found to be in violation of copyright law. And to most of us, we would have thought that falls under fair use. So it is a real area of gray.
But then it becomes part of case law.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes that judgment call in that one case sets a standard.
A precedent.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that I think is why it's sort of scary when you think, about really trying to understand anything that comes close to the line. I think as educators, we want to make people available of all of the wonderful things that are out there. But we also want to err on the side of not being sued and of, protecting work that needs to be protected. And it gets very complicated.
No kidding. And yes, and this event on the 25th, as we said earlier, is not just about don't do this, but it's also to help clarify, go ahead and do this.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's about open doors and closed doors both. And just by having a little more solid understanding of copyright protection and what it really does protect, that really makes all of us breathe at least a little bit easier,
right,
knowing that we're navigating through these matters in a more upright fashion, let's say. So Copyright Day at UW Parkside is Friday, September 25th, and people can go to a special website I know that has all the information. Where is that information found?
People can go to the Parkside website, so that would be www.uwp.edu, and then you go to Copyright Day. You could put that in the search area or just after the address in the URL /Copyright Day, one word, and find registration material, and people can register up until noon next Monday, the 21st. But after that, there's a number where people can call. And we really want to encourage people, even if you've missed the deadline for registering online, to call and see if there's still space. Because we are really hoping that people from all over will come to this, not just educators, but people from the community who are interested will come and join us. So we want a full house.
Very good. So that's 595-3340, I believe, the phone number that
yes.
people call. Very good. Lisa Konecki, Laura Mason, this has been fascinating. I'm so glad we had this conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I hope a lot of people partake of Copyright Day on the 25th of September.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will have a very fun time and a full house with six different cartoonists who are here for the next Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. So we are looking forward very much to a full studio of cartoonists on tomorrow's Morning Show. And you'll find The Morning Show archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education.